in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Lexis Bonso. As wildfires grow more frequent and intense across the West, families are preparing, stocking up on air purifiers, backup chargers, and emergency supplies. But for those living with terminal or serious illnesses, wildfires present a unique and dangerous threat. I spoke with Martha Beach about how families with serious medical needs can build smarter wildfire kits and how people can prepare for fast-moving evacuations when every second matters.
I am an acute care nurse practitioner. I work for the federal government with the VA, and my husband has a diagnosis of what a lot of people know as Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, and some might know it as motor neuron disease, essentially rendering a person paralyzed. Eventually it's progressive and requires toward the end of life a lot of medical equipment and a lot of medical attention.
What is your experience with emergency situations like wildfires?
With emergency situations, my husband and I were not only the victim of one hurricane, Hurricane Helene in September of 2024, where we lost our home, all of our vehicles and our belongings, but we then were the victims again of a second hurricane, two of the most damaging hurricanes to ever hit the state of Florida within 10 days of one another. So we were hit first with Hurricane Helene, and what was left of any part of our life was gone after Hurricane Milton. And so we had to evacuate very quickly. So it was very chaotic.
And why is it more difficult for people with serious medical conditions in these types of emergencies?
So the reason is, and I'll use my example, but because of my background, I have many examples, but I'll use my own. So my husband requires the use of a ventilator, a non-invasive ventilator. So that requires power. Without power, he would die. And so he uses what's called a cough assist. So in the event of an emergency, if he's choking, that too requires power. And many of his devices, such as a suction machine, also requires power. So mostly all of his medical care in some way or another, including the lift that helps get him in and out of the bed or his wheelchair, or even generating power to the wheelchair that has to be charged every night, requires the need for power. So these are large items, they're life-sustaining items, and they are not easy to move, and they require power. Without that, my husband would not be able to survive very long.
And how can families with serious medical needs build smarter wildfire kits?
Great question, and I think not only wildfire kits, but also any kit, anyone who lives at home who has special needs, especially catastrophic needs, catastrophic illnesses, where they're very complex, but this goes for anyone as well, but in terms of wildfire kits. So the first thing that I would recommend is, because of the diagnosis, because of the challenges that a person has in their living environment, make a list. It's never too soon. Make a list when you're not stressed. Make a checklist. And you have to really first start with what are the absolute necessities. So the necessities would be, in this example, all medical equipment that is used every day. And if you have backup medical equipment, any sort of backup batteries, make sure that they're always charged. Have them in a room somewhere where you can take the extra batteries with you. But you want to make on that checklist, because in these situations, You're going to be panicking. It's very difficult to think through and to go through your home to figure out what you can take as quickly as possible. So to have that list in your hand and you're checking it as you're going through. The other thing I would suggest is, in terms of a kit, most people, it won't all fit into a small kit. You want to think larger And I suggest going onto a website or to a large store that will sell containers. And I would advise containers with wheels that are easy to move and a handle. So maybe two or three of those large ones, the 100-gallon large ones that are stackable, that you can put in a room or a closet close to an entryway where you intend to escape or you need to escape. You want to make sure what's in there are things that you will be able to use for at least a week. I tell people in terms of making your kits, you start with all of the necessities, medications or a list of medications, supplies, backup batteries, anything related to the medical equipment. And again, if you have secondary equipment as backup, you want to make sure those are in those containers, neatly wrapped and ready to go. So at a moment's notice, you can grab them on the wheels and you can get them out of the house as quickly as possible with your checklist. So medications, personal supplies. If a person uses tube feeds or has special diets, you want to make sure that you have all of your supplies that go along with that as well. Any personal supplies with them as well, and as much as for 2 weeks. And what you're trying to think of when you're leaving, especially in the event of a fire, you don't have a lot of time to look around. So that's why I say have all of this packed up in two or three containers with wheels stacked in a room close to an exit that you can grab, throw it down on the ground, run with it with the handle to get to your vehicle to stack it in there. And with your checklist. And what you're trying to think very quickly, and I tell people, and I'm going by my own experience, take your phone and take pictures of everything, pictures of medications, prescriptions, supplies, anything that you need, take pictures of it. Take pictures of your driver's license, the front and back, your Social Security card, front and back, your medical cards, any of your insurance cards, front and back, your declaration page to any of your insurance, to your cars, to any of your vehicles, your home, any of your property. You want to take a picture of those front and back. And I suggest, if you can, download those onto a flash drive or a USB, and you want to keep that somewhere as well, protected with that bug out kit, and those bug out kits of those containers. So you want to be able to have those contact numbers and names. That's very important. If you have the luxury to be able to have a small, less expensive laptop, and all of these, make sure that you have your chargers, have extra chargers for your phones and for your electronics that you can put in there. And that would be part of your checklist that you can grab quickly. Because if you think about it, if you're never coming back to your home again, and you don't know, but if you're never coming back to your home again, you're going to have to find a place to go. You're going to have enough of the medical supplies and the needs that you're living with for at least a couple of weeks. And you're going to have to know where to go. But more than that, wherever you end up, you're going to be in a recovery mode. You're going to have to be able to get in touch with friends, family, loved ones, but you're also going to have to get in touch with your insurance agents if you have that, with FEMA, with any sort of assistance. You want those numbers close by. You want to be able to either access them on your phone, through the internet, through a computer, through a flash drive that you can pop in wherever you end up. These are critical. And people, these are the things that we lose when we run quickly out of the house. Just people without special needs. But this is catastrophic for people who have special needs and special challenges, and why it's so important, especially when a fire gives you very little to no time to get out. So beside getting yourselves out, that's how I would build your kits in that way. And they're different for each person, but you want to start out with all of the equipment that requires life-sustaining needs for your loved one or for yourself. You want to make sure if you've got any backup batteries, or you have the means or resources or the ability to get backup batteries for these devices, you have all of that in your kits. And when I think of kits, I think of the containers. As I said, easy to roll on wheels, stackable, close by, when you get ready to bug out of your house to get out as quickly as possible. And then you want all those important numbers, and rather than carrying a whole packet of paper, what you're trying to do is just make it easy, make it simple. If you can, take pictures and memorialize and save those pictures and keep them on a flash drive, send them to the cloud, send them to a place that you can retrieve them later on. And then finally, where are you going? I think a lot of people in a panic, especially with a fire, especially with a catastrophic event where you are having to evacuate, the chaos and the stress is playing and wreaking havoc on your ability to think. But you need to have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C of where you're going to go. Often people are already registered with agencies in the event of certain emergencies that they can go to a shelter. But in events where we're caught off guard, in particular a fire, it's not just chaos in your home, it's not just chaos in your mind, it's chaos in the community. And so you need to have those plans already set. And it's very, very important, if you require any power of any sort, if you have any device, even a CPAP machine that you use at night, anything that requires power, you want to try to make your plans be to places that you know have backup generators that are not going to lose power, or that don't are not going to run the risk of losing power. So if you have the ability to come up with three different hotels to go to, and then letting family know, hey, this is our plan, this is where we would go, we would be here, here, or here under my name, so people can find you. But you're not sitting in your car or your van panicking, where am I going to go next? You know, some of it is that you may not be able, the roads may be impassable, you're part of a large volume of traffic, but you're going to a place where it's predetermined, and you want it to be somewhere that is far enough away from where you are that you're out of harm's way. So you certainly don't want to go to a hotel or to someone's house that too can be the victim of what may be a raging fire that's out of control, or you're in the path of a hurricane or a tornado that may be, or horrible storms that are coming through.
Is there a role for neighbors to play?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad you asked about that. Our neighbors, we've been living in our home for 13 years. All of our neighbors, I developed a team, basically, when my husband, as he progressed and developed, his symptoms began to get worse. I was very prideful. I'm a nurse. I'm not used to asking for others to help. I'm usually the one running to help. And but over time, we shared and created a phone tree. And my neighbors know all of them. Everyone on my street knows us. We all know each other. We've shared phone numbers and a phone tree. So they know to come over to try to help. And so we have two or three neighbors immediately, once they're dealing with getting themselves safe, they're there as well, helping us as well. And we stay in touch with each other. So when we evacuated both times, within minutes of watching our house succumb to the flood, we watched our home become flooded with a tidal wave, a surge from the first hurricane until the power went out. We were watching it on the camera, and as it went out, the first thing we did was we started calling our neighbors and checking on them, and vice versa. We were all calling each other. We were already at a hotel, but we were already calling one another. So yes, neighbors play a wonderful role, and that also helps to let others know if they can't reach them. You want to have them, your neighbors also give family members neighbors' phone numbers, because they may not be able to reach them because their power has gone out on there, or maybe their phone has died, but I may have talked to them and my power is okay, and I can say, yes, they're safe. I just spoke to them 3 hours ago.
What sort of questions should people be asking themselves about their preparedness as we're heading towards wildfire season?
Yes, another great question. I would never, ever think it can't happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. That's the first thing that you need to be thinking of listening to me today. Never in my wildest dreams. I've always watched disasters on television. I've always donated. I've always helped out in a disaster. I never thought it would happen to me. In fact, we were in denial as we were being evacuated, as we were being told to evacuate. So the first thing is to accept this can happen to any of us. And I know when you live in a fire-prone zone, you are very well aware of that and have had experience with that. So that's the first, is coming to the reality. The second is, I would take a picture. I would take a full movie of your living arrangements, of your entire space, inside and out, a very long movie, memorializing, opening up drawers, everything, because you'll be amazed at what you forgot you had or you lost. And without that movie and those pictures, it becomes very hard in the chaos to remember all of those things, because you may have left something out that you didn't realize that you needed. So I would also take a movie, a very thorough movie. But I would slowly walk around your home with a pen and paper, or talking into your phone, a microphone, and taking notes. And I would walk around and I would list, starting with 1, 2, 3, everything that you use on a daily basis. Start from the time you wake up in the morning until the time that you go to bed at night. Walk through your routine, basic things, where you keep your car keys. Do you have an extra set? Where would you keep those? I personally would leave those in a bug out bag or a bug out kit for your fire kit, your escape kit. Or getting an extra set of keys. But I would walk through and I would go down, and that would be my checklist. 1, 2, 3. And then I would even recircle back. You know, I was talking earlier to someone about this exercise today and what advice to give through our experiences, since it's so raw and we're still in the recovery phase. I would also, as you're making your list, I would try to circle back around maybe once a month or every 6 weeks, and just do a check, because something could have changed. You may have gotten a new medication prescribed. You may have been given a new medical device. You may have gotten a different cane or whatnot. But you want to circle back around and you want to add those things. So I would keep that list handy, taped on the outside of, or maybe the inside of the door of the closet where your bug out kits are, your fire kits are, to escape, and add to it as you need to. And then I would ask others that live in the home, you know, sit down with them, and then also decide, hey, if this occurs, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to leave the house. This is the plan. And I would practice that plan.
What do you wish people knew more about this topic?
Empathy and kindness. These situations are overwhelming. And one of the things I think is very important, you may already have personal experiences with others surviving the fires this past year and other catastrophic events where their life has been altered. But realizing that I think the experiences themselves just leading up can also create a lot of anxiety. As you're mentioning, going into the season, the anxiety if they've had an experience before with it, but to recognize that those are very real feelings, and for others to, you know, realize and to talk about it. You know, if you've had an experience in the past, or you are anxious or nervous, and I would talk to others, what are you doing to prepare, and share what you've learned or share what you're doing. And I think that is very important. I've seen some beautiful bonding, community bonding. I've seen some humanity extended I didn't know could exist. It really, and you would be amazed at just the small words of encouragement as we go into a season like this. Just, hey, I'm here. Make sure we have our numbers updated. Don't hesitate to call me. I'll have my phone on all night, right? You know, check in with people as you start to move into the season.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, what do you recommend?
If you don't mind, I just wanted to finish one last thing because it's very near and dear to my heart. I definitely want to mention the pets and I failed to do that. We have three dachshunds, and we have car carriers that I have those as well, ready to go, and those stay with our kits that they go in as well. So and their food and what they need for roughly 2 weeks. And so if they need more information, I would go to FEMA website. They have some wonderful resources. I can say personally, what we have benefited from in terms of resources is community outreach. Samaritan's Purse was extremely involved in our communities here, and between FEMA and Samaritan's Purse, and they have also, the Forestry Service also has some very good resources as well. But I would also make sure that you're registered with your emergency management in your area, that you have special needs. You make sure that you're up to date, your address is up to date, your name is up to date, your phone is up to date in those systems, because that always is what you will end up if you can't get out fast enough or if you're having problems. They're there. That's what they're there for.
For Cable News in Depth, I'm Lexis Ponce.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Onyx. There are some safety concerns for boaters and swimmers in the spring and summer months ahead. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has some tips on how to stay safe while having fun.
My name's Tom Conning. I'm a public affairs specialist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
We've had a warm spring this year, and many folks look to our waterways or places to swim to cool off. It can be dangerous, especially in the early seasons. What are some of the risks?
Especially in the early spring and even into the summer, the water can be much colder than people anticipate. And the big difference between air temperature and water temperature can be a real shock if people are not prepared. So if you fall in unexpectedly, especially, you can gasp and inhale water. And then if you're not wearing a life jacket, it's very easy to succumb to drowning at that point.
What do statistics in Oregon and Washington say about drowning victims? Are there trends in the data?
I would say for Oregon and Washington, the amount of accidental drownings varies by year, and I'm not sure you could extrapolate anything specifically about how many per year you're going to see. But for the Army Corps data, we definitely see most of our victims are males, adult males between 18 and older, and really high percentage, in the 90%, are not wearing life jackets. And if you look at some of the other drowning statistics from other agencies, it's typically similar in the sense where most victims are male and most victims have not been wearing a life jacket.
How do waterway temperatures play in? What is a safe temperature to go in and go swimming?
I don't know if I could tell you an exact temperature that is safe per se, but typically water that's colder than 70 degrees will give you that kind of shock and would make you inhale unexpectedly. So below that, you just want to be aware of that. But again, wearing a life jacket in cold, wet water or even in warmer water is going to be helpful. Our water tends to be much colder than we expect because of just runoff from snowmelt. And then even if it's, you know, warmer than 70 degrees, swimming in natural water can be a lot different than swimming in a pool. So currents play into that. The things that are in the water, like snags or rocks or logs that you just are unaware of. And then a lot of times the kind of cooler water can sap your strength a little bit quicker than warmer water can. So that plays into your like maybe you're okay swimmer in the pool, but when you're losing some of your strength from swimming in colder water, that might be a problem as well.
Why are life jackets important for those who are going swimming?
Well, I mean, they're going to keep you afloat is the primary thing. So even if you fall in and hit your head, for instance, on something that you don't see, you'll be more easily rescued. Same thing with that unexpected gasp and you inhale water. If you don't have a life jacket on, you might start sinking. And so it's really hard for somebody to rescue you if you're not already floating. And we see this happen a good amount just in the local area of people who are swimming and go under, and then people can't find them, and then they eventually will turn up, the body will turn up later. But yeah, if you have a life jacket, you can recover yourself quicker if you're conscious, but it's also helpful for people who are rescuing you to be able to get to you.
What are some important steps people can take to keep themselves safe?
First of all, wear a life jacket. Second of all, kind of understand where you're going to go recreating. So learn about the area. So if you're going to go to a river, maybe look up that river and see if there are any obstacles on that river that you're unaware of. There were a bunch of river rescues last year near Eugene. There's a low head dam or a drop structure in the Willamette somewhere in the Eugene area. And those could be really dangerous because they're hard to see before you get to them. So looking up those types of things and just being aware of your surroundings while you're boating. Also, reducing alcohol consumption is important. I know that's not necessarily what people are going out there for. They want to go and have fun, but we do want them to do that safely so that they can come home.
What can happen if you're drinking while swimming?
It can cause disorientation when underwater. So say you're underwater and you're intoxicated, maybe you're running out of breath and you don't know which way is up. So that can be a problem. And then, you know, if you're boating and drinking, that's, I don't know what the Oregon law is as far as that goes for like a DUI type of thing, but, you know, your reaction time is slower. So if you're cruising around in the water and you see something that you want to avoid, you're going to have less reaction time to do that.
What time of year do most accidents happen?
We definitely see more people recreating for core properties kind of starting in the May time frame. We have Safe Boating Week, I think, is coming up next week. There's a Wear Your Life Jacket to Work Day on the 16th. So May is kind of our really starting time for us at the Corps of Engineers to start communicating water safety, and that typically goes throughout the summer and into September. In the Portland District Army Corps of Engineers area, we don't have anything directly downtown, but that core entity has a bunch of recreation areas in the Willamette, so like Detroit Lake. And then down near Eugene, there's a few different ones, and out near Sweet Home. So there's a bunch of different recreation areas that the Corps has, but we typically start refilling those reservoirs for recreation season starting in February. And then they typically try to fill them by Memorial Day, and then they start being drawn down for the winter after Labor Day. So it's kind of that May through beginning of September time frame where we're going to see a lot more recreation on the water as the temperatures rise.
What do you encounter with misconceptions that people might have about water safety?
I think the biggest misconception people probably have is that they are good swimmers, and that may be true in a swimming pool, but the swimming pool experience doesn't translate to open and natural water very well, like we kind of discussed before. So that's probably the biggest misconception is that people think they can swim. But again, if you fall over unexpectedly overboard and gasp and inhale water, your swimming ability doesn't matter at that point. And then the same thing goes if you fall overboard or if you're jumping into the water for fun and you hit your head on something and become unconscious, your swimming ability has nothing to do with that.
Where could people find more information on these life-saving tips?
So the Oregon State Marine Board has a lot of resources for water safety and boating safety. A lot of agencies, such as the Army Corps, have various material for that. A lot of places also have life jacket loaner stations if people don't have them. And I think you can just look those up online about, you know, where some of those are. But yeah, there's plenty of resources, and multiple agencies, Portland Fire and Rescue in the local area, and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, you know, all of our agencies are trying to communicate this same type of topic.
Is there anything else you would like people to know?
We're looking at the target demographic of mainly males 18 and older who don't wear their life jacket. So I think, you know, parents do a pretty decent job of making sure their kids are wearing their life jackets, but they don't model that behavior for them. And so I just think it's really important for adults to wear life jackets in front of their kids, so that becomes kind of a learned behavior overall, so that they don't think that, oh, well, I'm an adult now, I don't need a life jacket. So that would be an important thing for people to keep in mind.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tom Cunning from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers speaking with me about water safety. For KBOO News, I'm on.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.